The New Quantum Era,
a podcast
by Sebastian Hassinger
and Kevin Roney.
Hey, Kevin, how are you?
Hey, Sebastian, how's it going?
Very well, thank you. I'm very excited about our conversation on this episode. We talked to Joe Fitzsimmons, who's the CEO and founder of Horizon Quantum Computing, which is a quantum software company based in Singapore. Mm. He's really struck me as a very intelligent, which is a not unusual in the quantum space, but also really good, well-reasoned sort of thinker. He thinks things through very thoroughly, and he articulates his thoughts in a really clear manner. And we actually reached out to Joe because there was some recent coverage of quantum computing in the mainstream press that generated some sort of, you know, hyperbolic responses on both sides, I think, positive and negative to the coverage. And Joe had a Twitter thread that I think laid out a very well thought through position that balanced the pros and the cons of that type of mainstream article and just the overall perception of quantum computing in a really interesting way.
Yeah, exactly. I felt like he has just a nice, you know, sober, balanced tone of both being, you know, skeptical about some of the hype, but also, I mean, he's a long-term, you know, within the next decade or so, optimist. Yeah. That's a hard balance to get right. I mean, if you're somebody of rigor and authority in the field,
right.
I think he does it quite well.
That's right.
I just for the sake of helping our audience, some of the controversies related to this time cover story, I guess, called "What Quantum Computers Can Solve Countless Problems and Create a Lot of New Ones." I think that first hit the wire back in January 26th of this year.
That's right.
So yeah, that was the kickoff of some, you know, kerfuffle within the quantum computing space.
Yeah, and some of it was warranted. There's definitely some factually incorrect claims made in the article, but some of the criticism I think was over the top, because it happens whenever there are clear sort of statements that quantum computing has this enormous potential for disruptive change or transformative change. Mm-hmm. Whenever that type of statement gets made, you will find people sort of throwing stones, I think, and just saying, like, you know, this is purely smoke and mirrors. It's all theoretical. You haven't proven anything. It's never going to work. All the various arguments, and neither of those reactions is fully unwarranted or fully justified. And
yes,
I think that's
the
delicate balance that Joe really struck. And we just wanted to talk to him to give him a chance to talk about, you know, what his thoughts were behind that Twitter thread in more detail, since you know, no matter how long the Twitter thread is, it's always still a Twitter thread.
There it is. Well, great. So here's the interview with Joe.
Okay, we're here with Joe Fitzsimmons, CEO and founder of Horizon Quantum. And Joe, you live in Singapore, right?
Yeah, I do.
Well, thank you very much for joining us at this time. How long have you been in Singapore?
I moved out here at the end of 2010. So this is, I think, the start of my, well, a little over 12 years.
And so you must feel like a local by now. Wow, yeah.
Well, I mean, it takes some time, but it's, you know, it's probably one of the easiest places to live and to fit in.
Yeah, I've been very impressed with Singapore when I've gone there. I just went there last. Actually, we saw each other last summer when I was there. So I would love to hear how you ended up starting a quantum startup, a quantum computing startup. Can you take us through that history?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I guess different people have come to this industry through different paths. Mine, I guess, I see as the kind of most traditional path in some sense, even though it's a very young industry. So I did my undergrad in theoretical physics and went straight into a PhD in quantum computing. So I was exposed to quantum computing in the last year of my undergrad, which would have been 2003, 2004.
In what school?
I did the undergrad in University College Dublin.
Okay.
So I applied for PhD programs. I got accepted to one in NUI Maynooth, which is a small university in Ireland, a little bit outside Dublin. So I went there to start my PhD, and then, significantly less than 6 months in, my supervisor met with me and explained that he'd accepted a position in Australia and I could move over there, that there'd be a place for me there. But the way things were going, I was going out with a girl at the time. We're now married. So I mean, I guess I made the right choice to not leave.
Yeah, guess you did. Way to go. Yeah.
But so I started looking for new positions, found another opening in Oxford, moved over there. Mm. I'd already started the PhD in Ireland. So, I had some experience from there. Mm-hmm. So I went through the PhD, the DPhil in Oxford pretty quickly. So 2005 to 2007. And then I was a fellow in Merton College for up until the end of 2010.
And that's pretty unusual for an undergraduate program to have quantum computing at that point in time. That's very early adopter kind of mentality there in Dublin. Yeah. Do you think that's typical is there some reason why there was that sort of advanced thinking in that university?
You know, I can't necessarily explain the logic behind it because I wasn't part of those decisions. I've been involved in curriculum decisions since I was a professor after I moved to Singapore. It was kind of an odd arrangement because it was the only course that we didn't take in the university. So we had to go to the Dublin Institute for Advanced Studies, which is somewhere between UCD, where I went to university, and Trinity College Dublin. And people from both universities were going there for this one quantum computing course. There was a professor there who had worked on some quantum information problems, quantum computing problems. So it was, it was an interesting course. It was interesting to get exposed that early on to it. It was a decade old at that point. But still.
Yeah, still that's way back. Impressive. Yeah, good stuff. Early start, no doubt.
Absolutely. And defining your PhD, when you said you did a PhD in quantum computing, was it sort of formally recognized as being specifically quantum computing or quantum information science? Or
Oxford DPhils don't say departments on them. They just say the title of the thesis.
I see.
So mine is like Architectures for Quantum Computing Under Restricted Control.
Oh, interesting.
Very cool.
So it was mostly about, how to build a quantum computer if you can't get access to all of the operations you may want. So if you have to entangle qubits by making optical measurements, for example, like in ion traps now, or if you have to do the same operation to every qubit because perhaps you can't resolve each individual qubit.
Interesting.
Turns out it's possible in both cases you can make universal quantum computers.
Right. That's interesting. So, at that point, what was the year again when you were doing your PhD by the time you got to Oxford is
2005 to 2005.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So very early days of experimental realization of qubits. And I think there's some superconducting early experiments, NMR primarily, and some early trapped ion at that point, right?
Well, so NMR and trapped ions have been around for, you know, close to a decade at that point of experimental demonstration of quantum information processing. Superconducting qubits were at a much earlier stage of development. So if you look through the kind of history of superconducting qubits, the coherence time on superconducting qubits has changed dramatically over the last 20 years. So ions less so, right? But ions are the same now as they were, you know, as they've always been, as they were since the Big Bang.
Presumably, as they always will be, right?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, so you see less change there than you do in superconducting qubits. But the net result of this is that superconducting qubits were not the most promising system at that time. So my knowledge of superconducting qubits is significantly less than other kinds of systems, whether that be like NMR or ion traps or optical quantum information processing, or like NV centers, things like this.
Right.
That's an interesting perspective. I mean, I wonder, would you classify as an optimist or a pessimist on the transmon architecture, the superconducting qubit architecture? What do you think? Is it still in your mind the plausible leader to get to quantum advantage?
Oh, I mean, you know, it certainly picked up steam. over that intervening 17 years. There's been a lot of development. So what I would say is that I'm not an experimentalist. I'm not the best one to tell you what the best way to build a quantum computer is. And I am occasionally reminded of that. But if you look at what the community kind of judges, one way you can do this is there's a report that's written every year for the Global Risk Institute. Marco Piani and Michaela Mosca write it. And they ask about 50 people in the community, generally experts in different areas, algorithms, error correction, fault tolerance, and experimental systems. And they ask them basically questions that are used to estimate a timeline to quantum computers posing a risk to cryptography, and in particular to RSA 2048. And one of the questions that you're asked as a respondent on this survey is to rank the systems as most likely and least likely in terms of getting to this threshold. Now, it's not asking you about 1,000 years from now, what will quantum computers look like? You know, it's about this one particular threshold area. When you build a system with about 6,000 logical qubits that can, you know, that can support, you know, several billion or tens of billions of operations without error, that's a particular size system. And consistently, the top two systems that come out in that ranking are ion traps and superconducting qubits, with photonics coming third. And then you see spin systems, you know, silicon, quantum dots, and so on coming behind.
Uh-huh. Useful overview. Thank you. We'll probably just post a link to that, the report in the notes, no doubt. Thank you.
Definitely. So then, what was the transition from Oxford to Singapore? You said actually you were a professor, I think, at NUS, right? Was that what brought you to Singapore initially?
So what happened was I was coming to the end. I was a fellow in Merton College, which is a really nice gig if you can get it straight out of your PhD. You know, essentially you don't have a boss. You do your own research and you may not be paid terribly well, but it's a very nice lifestyle of being able to have your dinner in college and go punting on the river and stuff like that. but yeah, it's coming to the end of that. It's a 3-year appointment. So I was looking for other positions. Arthur Eckert was a professor in the same, he was a fellow in Merton as well. So he had also been one of the examiners on my PhD thesis. So he was my internal examiner. And he suggested that I should apply to Singapore because he was at that point director of the Center for Quantum Technologies, which was kind of getting up and running at the time. It had only been running a few years. And I'd visited once or twice, I think 2008, 2009. So it seemed kind of attractive. My wife is Chinese, so actually culturally it's a good fit as well, in terms of location. So, you know, she can get the food she likes and so on. So, yeah.
The food is very good in Singapore.
I so want to go sometime just for the food. My God. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it ended up being a good fit. I moved over, as I said, end of 2010, initially as a senior research fellow in the Center for Quantum Technologies.
Okay.
Then I moved to Singapore University of Technology and Design. I got a National Research Foundation Fellowship, which is quite a big personal grant that they give you in Singapore early in your career, or I mean that they give some people early in their career. So it's about $3.5 million Sing dollars. So it's quite a lot of money for starting a group. So I built up a fairly large research group at that point. I had already been supervising a postdoc in CQT, but that kind of expanded the group, grew to about 14 people. Got tenure there in 2018 and then resigned to start Horizon. Or rather, the company existed on paper before that.
Since it's still very impressive. I mean, wow, just a great anecdote. Wow. Good ride.
Well, we'll see.
By the startup bug. From here. We'll see. We'll see. Exactly.
Well, really, thank you for the overview. These are always fun conversations. Just a little warm up to hear your pathway. I mean, one of the key issues that the themes that we've been talking about on this podcast for some time is, you know, the balance between, you know, how do you get to a clear-sighted, you know, conversation about the future of quantum computing, right? It feels like there's, you know, a lot of hype that I think it comes from either people that are not well informed about it, or you know, feel like they can apply the history of Moore's law to quantum computing, or you know, also some pessimism, which we think is sometimes warranted and sometimes a little bit too much. How do you find a balance that you know, really sees both the potential and acknowledges the significant problem? So that was one of the bits of your writing that we saw that really drew us to seek you out for an interview. Because, that feels like the substance of a lot of what we're trying to delve into in this very podcast. So we were hoping we could just do a little back and forth with you on that topic, huh?
Sure. So, I mean, I should say sometimes I write these Twitter threads when I've become a little bit frustrated with something that I've, something else I've seen on Twitter or something like this.
Sure.
I don't do it very often, but
it was a very gentle rant. If you're saying that was a rant, it was very, very kind.
Yeah, it was very diplomatic, we thought. Yeah.
Well, you know, there's a couple of things you need, at least from my perspective. And to be honest, I think most people don't think about it clearly. I think that there has been a bifurcation in the community that pulls people towards two extremes, and neither of those extremes is correct. And I guess you can see how it happens, right? That, you know, one thing when you come up through the academic system that is very important to you is let's say intellectual honesty and rigor, and it's really important not to be telling stories about the world as it is supposed to be that are not accurate. So if you if you look at it this way, you can look at some of what has happened in the quantum industry, and you can see a lot of hype. You can see things, you can see plenty of statements that are not true. So, unfortunately, in the article that led to that, there are a number of things that are factually incorrect.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but just for the benefit of our audience, you know, you're directly referring now to that Time cover story, Time magazine, and it would just be helpful for our audience who may have read it or may not have. I mean, a quick, if you could, a concise itemization of the, I don't know, the key ideas. It could go on too long. I'm just trying to, again, for the benefit of those who are listening, get a summary in.
Sure. So, I mean, what I can say is I thought it was cool to see quantum computing on the cover of Time. A lot of my colleagues disagreed. in terms of the criticism that has gone around of the article, essentially there is several aspects of it. First of all, it gives an incorrect statement about how the world currently is. So it talks about how quantum computing is currently being used to optimize logistics, to make healthcare decisions and things like this. And I really hope no one is using quantum computing to make healthcare decisions. We should not be doing this.
Or definitely mess up our global supply chain. Right, yeah.
I mean, that's the cause.
Maybe that's it. That's why we're having all the problems, right?
So a thing that is weirdly obfuscated from the point of view of if you're an external observer looking in at quantum computing, it's not clear how useful quantum computing has been to this point.
That's right.
To different industries and so on. Like there's a lot of claims out there, and what's really important to understand is it has not been. There has yet to be a clear demonstration that quantum computers can solve a meaningful problem more efficient than conventional computers with existing hardware. That milestone has not yet been reached. We know it's possible. We know you can factor large numbers and you can break codes in ways that you cannot do with conventional computers, but we haven't reached that point yet.
Right.
And there's lots of applications that we believe will be useful. But one of the things that's happening at the moment is as quantum computing becomes more commercial, there are quite a lot of industrial engagements for POC projects where people are applying quantum computing to various different kinds of commercially oriented problems, writing up results, putting out press releases, because I guess for many of the companies, part of the value of doing the POC is the PR value of the output. So this leads to a situation where people believe potentially that quantum computing is being widely used to address all of these problems, but it isn't yet. It's not yet at the point of actually offering an advantage in production. In fact, most of the hardware that's out there, you're not allowed to use for production.
It's interesting. You started by framing this as, you know, when you're coming from academia, from scientific research, it's considered not good form to represent things as you want them to be rather than as they are. It's interesting to me because I think in part what's happening is this is tech marketing, right? It's actually a collision of two different mindsets. And tech marketing, you know, fake it till you make it sounds sort of sinister, except that you have to bear in mind that the pace of technological innovation is sufficiently fast in classical digital technologies where you can sort of go like, oh, we're going to be able to do X because 6 months from now you will be able to deliver that. And this
those early movers, those people that made the original bet, I mean, it turned out great, right? Yeah, right. That expectation is going to go that way is pervasive, yes.
Yeah, so I agree. I agree that there's definitely a clash of cultures that contributes to this. What I would say is that, at least for us, in terms of Horizon, we've been, you know, revisiting our values we're going through the process at the moment, but one of the core values for us is integrity, both in science and in business. And, you know, you have the potential issue of misleading people about where the science is at, being, you know, seeming to be a violation of what you might think of as a kind of scientific integrity. But you also see it when it comes to companies like Theranos, where that also leads to massive issues in terms of business integrity. And we cannot be said in the same sentence as companies like that. So quantum computing has an issue that it is not yet fully realized. And if you add on to that the misleading statements, then it gets you into a real troublesome area. But the other side to this. So you need to be clear about where you stand mm-hmm. now. And we should be able to agree on where we stand now. And if we're not able to, there might be a problem. Now, maybe you know something I don't know. Maybe someone knows about progress within a company that mm-hmm. is not public, or, you know, within a government lab or something that is not public, and they know something's been achieved that I don't know has been achieved yet. That's completely possible.
Absolutely.
You probably wouldn't expect it to be a massive leap.
Right.
yeah. So we should
they
have
are rare in history.
yeah. So we should have a fairly... We should have a fairly good estimation of approximately mm-hmm. where things stand at the moment. Mm-hmm. You know, then there's the question of where are things going? And that's where I think particularly the clash of cultures can also
right.
go really different directions. So, you know, an issue here has also been that there's a culture when you're coming from the academic side, of there's certainly pressure to not do something that would be bad for the community. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that has been seen historically as being bad for the community is saying that you're going to build a quantum computer.
Is that the right way?
Because the idea, at least my sense of where this is coming from is that if you say you're going to build a quantum computer, you draw in funding to do it and you fail to deliver, mm-hmm. then those same funding agencies will be reluctant to do it.
Right.
For other teams that might be able to do it. Yes.
And to be brutally honest, every experimental effort believes they're the only experimental effort that can work.
Have you noticed that? it is a bit of a religious landscape in a way. It's like my qubits are the only true qubit.
So, I mean, it's
and
just...
I'm sorry, Joe, I have to read for the backstory on this. I mean, how many research projects tried and crashed and burned on...
Oh, there have been a few.
We see the prominent successful examples, but the ones that are dead are kind of forgotten. Do you know how many have been...
Sure. If you look back even before I entered the fields, there were attempts to build quantum computers that just turned out to be much harder than people thought they were going to be. Certainly in the, you know, I've gone through several phases. I have this, I have these slides that I show sometimes in public talks of the number of qubits with time, and it kind of increases up to about 2005 and then kind of stagnates and mm-hmm. then starts increasing again around 2016. So, you know, there have certainly been situations, and I don't want to get into this too much because, you know, sometimes these are attributed to particular individuals and so on. So I don't want to. There have definitely been situations in the past where people have felt that this has happened. For sure, there was a very strong backlash against D-Wave in the mid-2000s for making claims that they were building quantum computers that they clearly did not have, they were not building. And that, you know, that led to, you know, there's many examples on this front, but it happens in the academic realm as well. So there's this notion of endangering funding. And I think one thing that's sometimes missed is that the funding won't continue forever. The funding is now at a higher level because people sense it's closer.
That's right.
And if we don't deliver now, that funding's going away. You can't preserve it. You actually have to use it to make forward progress.
Right.
I mean, it might result in a bit of a temporary winter, and maybe quantum funding would return. I mean, just like artificial intelligence and others, there were, you know, there are ebbs and flows of spikes,
of enthusiasm. AI winter's long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was not fun, mm-hmm. right, for a lot of people. Yeah.
So, you know, there's a couple of sides to it, but yeah, I mean, you could burn funding for 15 or 20 years, right?
Like, right. Yeah, if easy.
if the current moment, if it fails, you know, we just stall out at qubit, at a couple of hundred qubits that are noisy and we cannot get beyond that, then it's going to put everyone off quantum computing for quite a long time.
Right.
Now, I don't think that's going to happen. But, you know, there is
that danger. What you're saying is that that is in the back of the mind of people who would basically would have a negative opinion. As you said, it may harm the community, that taking that funding is setting up a failure condition that'll spoil the funding for a long
time. For many
others,
potentially.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the other part of this article, though, is forward-looking statements about how disruptive quantum computing may be, and various implications of that. But that's where I feel like we really, you know, get into a situation where it's not about being honest about where we currently stand. It's about different possible futures. And realistically, I'm not sure if you come up through a path like I did, you're all that much better placed to talk about where things are going than if you came up through the tech industry, for example.
Interesting. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know,
it's speculative.
It is.
You just
speculative
need an imagination.
And we're missing things. So,
right.
You know, if you come up through the academic path, you don't necessarily have the same perspective in terms of how capital can change, you know, can lead to rapid change, because mostly you're talking about small research groups doing things. And they can have more funding or less funding, but it's not at the point of like TSMC building a fab kind of level, right? So if you look at the projected costs of 2-nanometer fabs, they're about the same as all of the money that has been spent or committed in quantum computing over all time to this point, right? Including forward commitments, right? So I don't think people in the field really have that sense
of the scale.
Of what happens. And I also think they're a little bit more distant from what has happened in the history of computing. I looked it up the other day, and the first computer I had in the processor had 3,500 transistors.
Right.
You know, my laptop definitely does not have 3,500 transistors in the processor.
Probably just a few more.
Probably has one in every key, has 3,500 transistors, every key in the keyboard.
So we're getting to a point where actually the number of qubits we have and so on, they're starting to look not that dissimilar from reasonably early PCs and so on. We lack memory, though, and that's an issue.
Yeah.
And we haven't really gotten to a point where we've componentized the systems. So at the moment, everyone's trying to build these giant monolithic processors that are everything. They're all of the memory, they're all of the processing, and there is no structure to them necessarily. There's no ALU, there's no FPU. You just have essentially like the equivalent of an FPGA that you're trying to program,
and you just sequence some gates at it and run. Where you go
exactly? Yeah. Like everything is software defined because it's defined in these pulse sequences that are going to the devices. Mm-hmm. For most systems, I guess optical systems are a little bit different in that sense. So you're in this situation where actually the systems are starting to look like systems from maybe the history of computing. Noise level's a bit high, but we've had noise before in computers. Error correction is used now in, whether that be on large scale systems or whether it be in communications links and so on.
Right. And do you think part of the issue might be like over indexing on, you know, Shor's algorithm was sort of the quantum shot around the world. And as you said, you referenced before, you get, 6,000 fault tolerant qubits and you can crack most codes that exist today. Are we like expecting too much? Are we expecting to get to there, like a big bang where we get a system that does that? And that's where everyone's sort of anchoring on that level of functionality, maybe not specifically around cryptography, but that level of functionality of a very robust, mature system. When, as you said, your first personal computer had 3,500 transistors, there was a whole era of that we forget about now of even pre microprocessor, electronic computers that were doing real work in specific use cases that might actually unlock that industrial interest and therefore scale that you were describing before.
I guess the answer to this is that I don't really know. For sure, you can do things that are smaller than Shor's algorithm. You can do it with smaller than 6,000 qubits. I think there's estimates that some of the chemistry algorithms start to work around 200 qubits.
Right.
But these are low noise qubits. Now, if you ask me what path does quantum computing take from here, I'm not sure that it's, you know, each qubit encoded in 1,000 physical qubits. I'm not sure I believe that that's where we go. We might demonstrate it. You might see it demonstrated that, with that a couple of sort logical qubits.
That being the leading sort of strategy for error correction is having a logical qubit made up of a physical, collection of noisy qubits.
Yeah, so quite a few efforts look at surface code encodings, for example, where you're imagining encoding a single logical qubit into maybe 1,000 or even 10,000 physical qubits. And that's very wasteful. We don't do that in classical computing.
Right.
And there's not really a clear reason why we would have to quantum mechanically. We know that it's possible to do many to many encodings or few to many encodings rather than one to many. And that would certainly save a lot, but it's less explored from the point of view of fault-tolerant gate sets and so on.
Interesting.
But really, these things are very sensitive to the noise rates of the individual qubits. If you bring that noise rate down, you need less qubits for the encoding. And that's clearly what has to happen. And that's, you know, that's an argument for why ions are good, because actually there's not that many different sources of errors and you can start knocking them off one at a time. And as you knock them off, you just gain more and more nines. Now, I'm not saying it's easy to knock off these sources of error, but there are at least finitely many of them. Superconducting qubits is a little bit different because they're manufactured. They're not perfect by their nature. But still, you know, the performance of superconducting qubits has increased and increased and increased and increased. And yeah, we're still a long way from having essentially errorless qubits. But you can see a path where actually the control over the systems gets significantly better so that you're well below the fault tolerant threshold. And at that point, the effort you need to put in is much smaller.
Interesting.
So if you tell me that you are going to try to make a fault-tolerant quantum computer and your individual qubits, they are good to, let's say, you know, 7 nines or 8 nines, then that's not going to be so hard for you, actually. Right. If you tell me they're good to 2, it's going to be really hard.
Yeah.
You're going to need an enormous system.
It's an interesting analogy or comparison you're making between, you know, how at some point quantum computing might take on the shape of maybe a Moore's law, you know, kind of like growth curve as you say, you've seen in silicon for the past many decades.
Well, it is already.
The data perhaps seems limited, but it looks interesting. I mean, do you feel then pretty certain that curve's going to continue? Are you firm on that that prediction?
So what I would say is if you look back to the start of, you know, first experimental demonstrations, and you plot the data points for the largest number of physical qubits in a system, I'm only talking about systems where you can perform all of the gates. If you plot it on a log-log scale, from 95 or 96, whenever the first one is, up to around 2015, there is a straight line. On that semi-log plot. So there's exponential growth. What happens, the problem is the doubling time is every 5 years. compared to Moore's law of about every 2 years to 18 months, right? If you plot it now from kind of 2015, 2016 to the present, there is also a straight line, but now there's a kink at that point. Mm. So that the slope of the curve has changed, but it's more or less two straight lines with a slight interpolation between them. Uh-huh. And that is going up around, you know, doubling times more like once a year. Hmm. And that's faster than Moore's law.
Wow.
Significantly faster than Moore's law.
Yeah.
So, you know, it means that we could get to large scale systems significantly quicker than we might otherwise expect. But at the same time, this doesn't really track the error rates, because as you build larger systems, you tend to a bit of a dip in performance before they come to the same level.
Yeah. In the vendors where you've had multiple generations of every of a certain chip design, it's really interesting seeing like T1 and T2 rates and gate fidelities with first gen to second gen to third gen. That's when it feels more like engineering than science. It's like, okay, we got the science to build the thing the first time, and now we just have to turn the engineering cranks to get better at fab and get better at, you know, preparing the material and all of the things that we know from, you know, I mean, that's where sort of the broader scope of technology can be brought to bear, right? I mean, fabbing is something we've been doing for a long time now with semiconducting. And so there's lots of techniques. Anyway,
I agree. And like, this is one of the things that I think can be misleading to people.
Hmm.
That you can think, well, if I can't do it in my lab, it can't be done. And I don't think it's necessarily seen, well, what if I throw $27 billion at the problem and build a special facility to do this, which TSMC does, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's how they get to, like, modern processors. It's a different, it's definitely a different way of thinking. So at least from my perspective, I think there's going to be more of a shift in that direction as we get to larger scale systems. But you're right. Like, it's not surprising that the bleeding edge in terms of qubit number, that you see a performance drop. And then as there is time for those to mature, you see the performance increase slowly.
Right.
So our largest systems will always be our least performant, you know, in terms of fidelities. I'm sure that'll be true for, you know, essentially forever.
I guess another dimension of performance improvement. I mean, I'm not sure if you agree, but I mean, several people have been pointing at the last 12 months have pointed towards really significant advances in quantum error correction. Like, some people even think it's been one of the most notable past 12 months in quantum error correction in a very long time. I mean, that this perhaps could set up, I mean, a further acceleration, a further arcing up of that curve. What do you think?
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess what I would say is that there's a huge amount of work to be done on quantum fault tolerance. We've started to see a lot of physical demonstrations. Lots of efforts are getting to the point where they're able to demonstrate fault tolerant gate sets, where you're starting to see suppression of noise and so on. So we're getting closer to that kind of demonstration of sustained error correction, sustained fault tolerant operation. We're not there
crossing
yet.
That threshold, as mentioned in the threshold theorem. Yeah.
So, I mean, you don't want to do it just a single shot. You want to be able to repeat it
and
suppress it further and further and do your operations in that setting. And, you know, there can be, not all systems are capable of this because many systems don't allow mid-circuit measurements. What is necessary to make a mid-circuit measurement is highly disruptive to the rest of the system, so you end up introducing extra errors. But the reality is we're clearly getting closer to that.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting closer and closer. At the same time, from the theory, you're seeing improvements as well. So you're seeing that, I mean, there's, you know, even really quite simple things. For example, if you take a surface code and you pick your stabilizers slightly differently, so it's still the same surface code, it's just the local basis is rotated, you can take advantage of bias and noise. So frequently, the noise affecting qubits affects them more in one axis than another.
Hmm.
And you know, this one simple change can lead to you being able to exploit bias to get much better performance.
Wow.
So yeah, there's quite a lot happening. For a long time, the focus had been on proving that fault tolerance was even possible. And you know, under what assumptions it was possible. And it's only, you know, it's quite recent that the focus has been on concrete numbers, on like mm-hmm. how many physical qubits do I need to do X and so on. And I think as we have moved towards that, we've seen more changes, like more changes in our understanding of fault tolerance mm-hmm. as the goals have shifted. They've kind of pointed mm-hmm. us in new directions. And we've started to see progress for sure.
It's really interesting. Go ahead, Sebastian.
Oh, I was going to say, do you think part of that, the skepticism from the quantum community, you already called out the sort of perception of risk to the community by taking money and then failing. And then do you think that, and then you described, you know, not understanding what industrial scale investment can do to get you over the threshold, actually, if you get, you know, some limited success, it's attractive enough to capital will mobilize and make it into a large success. But then what you just described there about the landscape of fault tolerance, do you think there's an effect of almost siloing of people seeing, you know, let's say gate fidelities and not tracking the evolution of thinking around surface code, or only looking at surface code and not understanding the gate fidelities. I mean, that's a simplistic example.
But I don't think there's any problem in how people think about this. I think we've just had different goals over time.
Mm.
I mean, actually, if we want to get to a fault-tolerant quantum computer, like to an essentially noiseless quantum computer, there is, in principle, a path. The problem is, problems that have occurred over time for, you know, why we are not further ahead on this problem, for example, is that, you know, like one example is just noise models, right? So, you know, you maybe prove fault tolerance is possible within some set of assumptions, but that set of assumptions does not mirror how real devices work.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't necessarily know that that wouldn't be an accurate description of the real devices, or wouldn't be a reasonable idealization. And we see it now more.
Mm-hmm.
So in general, we know that correlated noise is bad, or non-Markovian noise is bad because we haven't proved the theorems in that regime. But actually, non-Markovian noise, you can often deal with by kind of spin echo techniques and so on. It's like, it's a memory effect for the most part. Mm-hmm. And you can often use that memory effect to cancel out the noise that has happened.
Hmm.
You know, so these things which are bad in terms of the theorems, because you've entered a regime where the theorem assumptions no longer hold, they're not actually necessarily bad. And figuring out how to take advantage of some of these things is important. So even bias noise, I mean, if I remember correctly, the first time I really came across that being examined properly was, I think I saw a talk at QEC in 2007 when I think it was Panos Eleftheris and John Preskill had a paper that was showing that you could get much higher thresholds if the noise was biased.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, getting to that point, you know, not having... You know, like you can prove different things if you have to assume it's like adversarial noise, or if you have to, or if you're assuming it's like stochastic poly noise, or like whatever your assumption on the noise is, they lead you to different conclusions.
Hmm.
But actually, what we care about is the real devices. And as we start to see more of the constraints and more of what's actually happening in those devices, it will lead us in new directions.
Yeah.
For sure, because we'll be getting closer to what's actually possible.
Well, we were having such a great time talking with Joe, and he's got a ton more to say, and we decided to split this episode into two parts. So it was really terrific for me to hear him sort of expand on that Twitter thread, explaining his reasons for being really optimistic about where the industry and the technology is today and where it's going. And I thought in particular, it was really interesting just sort of pointing out how academia may not be fully grasping the what you can accomplish when you really can mobilize mountains of capital to get something done.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, we try on this podcast, I hope it's coming off, to set a sober balance, right, between, you know, the optimism, but also being resistant towards the marketing hype. But I think he's got a valid point there. I mean, look at the huge transformation that happened in the 20th century around, you know, space and orbital technologies. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was this lead up for like over 100 years of like huge theoretical breakthroughs and experimental results. I mean, the likes of Robert Goddard and all this amazing rocketry he did back then, rather obscure at the time, but still, I mean, it wasn't really a lot of effort, but, you know, good, powerful contributions. Or also the mathematics of Tsiolkovsky's equation for, you know, orbital calculations and how much fuel you have to get up on orbit. I mean, really great stuff, but it was just early phases of research. And then nation-state competition and huge amounts of nation-grade resources came pouring in, and armies of people started to work on this, and it was a complete phase change,
right?
In the race to the moon. So I think he's got a valid point here.
Yeah, I agree, and I thought that, you know, that's a great example of the race to the moon. And I thought his current example of sort of like the capital it takes to build a 2-nanometer microprocessor fab is something on the order of $27 billion, which TSMC is currently investing in building that fab. That it's justified because of the size of the opportunity for that advanced technology.
Crazy and chunk of change right there, yeah.
Many times more than has been invested in quantum computing as a whole to date.
Top to bottom. There it is.
Top to bottom. So join us if you enjoyed this part. Join us for the second part. We'll be releasing it in 2 weeks. And Joe's going to start digging into the technology that he and his team are building at Horizon, which was also extremely interesting. And
really had cool.
some really, I had found it really eye-opening in terms of the potential quantum advantage being much broader than most people tend to view it in the current context. So
yeah,
tune in for that.
A real optimist he is. It's really good.
Absolutely.
Okay, that's it for this episode of The New Quantum Era, a podcast by Sebastian Hassinger and Kevin Roney. Our cool theme music was composed and played by Omar Costa Hamido. Production work is done by our wonderful team over at PodFi. If you are at all like us and enjoy this rich, deep, and interesting topic, please subscribe to our podcast on whichever platform you may stream from. And even consider, if you like what you've heard today, reviewing us on iTunes and/or mentioning us on your preferred social media platforms. We're just trying to get the word out on this fascinating topic and would really appreciate your help spreading the word and building community. Thank you so much for your time.